ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's Green Thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. See homedepot.com/delivery for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Corbacero, and it is great to be back, everyone. Obviously out one day later this week just due to a few logistics. For our diehard fans are probably wondering where it was on their Wednesday. We are out now. Thank you for your support and thank you for listening. This week's guest is Alex Lowe from The Times, returning to the show again. We kind of just have a back and forth over a lot of the key topics and stories of the week. You know, we start with reacting to the Premiership results on the weekend, looking at the playoff implications, the run-in for the Premiership. We then talk Ollie Woodburn, yellow card, Jack Noel in trouble with his tweet with RFU disciplinary, what those ramifications for players are going forward and how it impacts the game. And then we talk a little bit about Worcester Warriors and WAS. We get an update there of what's been going on with those clubs. And then lastly, finish with some big picture discussions of, you know, Premiership rugby, RFU restructuring, a bit of what I talked about last week on the pod in my opening about, you know, how the Premiership and RFU could work together. Some good insight from Alex there and some inside knowledge of he knows things that are going on behind the scene. And I get some of my utopian pipe dreams out there and have someone to at least bat it back or shut it down. So, you know, really good to have Alex back on the pod. Lots to talk about. It's a long interview, so let's get into it. And we are joined by the returning Alex Lowe. Welcome back to the pod, mate. It feels like a while, but good to have you back on. How's things going?
Yeah, it has been a while. No, thanks for having me. Yeah, things are good this end. The sun's out. We're about to get some summer rugby, which is, as the spectators, we all enjoy. It's a bit harder work for the players, but we're good. How are you? How's your season going? I saw you in that picture of you on Instagram, like you're Travis Kelce kind of strutting into the game.
To be fair, I was quite chuffed to have a photo. I never really get much content from being a coach. And then the fact that the photographer had something to me, I was pretty chuffed. And
mate, you'll be hosting Saturday Night Live before you know it.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a sunny day. So that was kind of like our festive shirt as such, like almost like Hawaiian style shirt. But then the clouds came in. But yeah, all the coaches wore it for the game and everyone wore it after. It was a debut of that ensemble. But I was chuffed with it. Season coaching's been good, mate. We are, I want to say, 7-1 in the top of the West, top overall. So fingers crossed. We got away game this week, but then we got three big games against two of those three are against our two biggest rivals in the division. So, you know, TBD, but it's trending in the right place. And I'm pretty happy considering there was a lot of change in the off season, and we've kind of a new team, even though there's some returning. And to be in this position already hopefully gives me confidence that we can keep growing and building, because I think there's a lot more in us. Also got my tight end Luke Green from London Irish, which has been fantastic to work with him. And something I've been absolutely chuffed about is that, you know, London Irish would trust us with the development of one of their props, you know, mainly because I feel like we get to work together and I get to really help him develop his set piece. And I've been excited with the progress we've made in a few weeks, and I would quietly tell everyone to keep an eye out for him next year in the Prem, because he's going to be a force.
It's a really interesting development that, because I'm actually going to London Irish on Thursday to go and see some of the Rob Simmons and some of their guys, and there's been an issue over in the Prem, as you know, of young players not getting enough game time. So to get them to come over and join you, get all that expert coaching from you, of course, turn him into a monster, and then send him back to the Prem, it's a great opportunity for him.
Absolutely. Because coming from a great environment, a great program, like London Irish, the academy is phenomenal. You know, scrum coach, you got Ross McMillan there, who I played with, who's done a fantastic job with that pack. And I think, you know, for them to trust me to really work on his front row detail, which, you know, my bread and butter is around crouch bind set and a lot of the stuff that decide the big games, and to be able to pass that on to someone, I'm excited, especially someone as physically as impressive as Luke, that I think when we crack it, you know, I do feel like, you know, the sky's the limit for this kid.
Class, well, we will look out for him.
I do really think that the MLR should be a potential option for a lot of these Prem academies who maybe have, you know, I would say it's probably going to suit more forwards, because by the time backs are old enough to play probably in the MLR, they should be there or thereabouts in their Prem squads. But I'd say maybe front row, second rows, the odd back row, guys that maybe develop a little later to get a season, maybe once they're done with the under 20s, where they're a starter, it's a league, you travel. It's just so, I think there's just so much more to it and beneficial than playing in the champ and going on loan, that I do think in the future, this hopefully will be one of more of the groundbreaking, you know, first sort of, you know, pilot runs of what could be a development pathway for many more to follow.
Yeah, great. And a great experience for him too. Just a lot, great life experience to go and spend a few months living in San Diego.
Oh, he's never left Sunbury, you know, pretty much. And now, you know, he's in San Diego, he's exploring, but he's working hard and getting filled in and training and scrumming all the time. Like, it's a, you know, what a life experience exactly. But let's get into today and where we're going with this one. I think, first of all, Prem Rugby, absolutely heating up. You know, what we want to see is, you know, not knowing the top four till as close to the final weekend as we can, which I think we'll get with this London Irish Northampton Saints heat after Saints, you know, pulling out against Saris. What are your thoughts on the Prem and where it's sitting running into the playoffs now?
I think I'm right saying that going into last weekend, there were 9 teams who could still qualify for the semi-finals for the playoffs, which is the most there's ever been. It's the closest league that there's ever been. And even, I think, the difference between top and bottom is closer than ever before. And it rates really highly with all the other kind of frontline competitions around the world in terms of closeness of games and numbers of tries scored. So on those elements, the league's trending really well, and it's super competitive. And as you say, we had 9 going into last weekend who could have made the playoffs. That number's coming down. Mathematically, Exeter Chiefs still can, but they can't really. Harlequins are right on the outside of it. It really feels now like you say, it's Northampton Saints or London Irish. And it'd be great. Oh, London Irish haven't played for a month, and they sat there last weekend seeing all the teams below them lose. They're coming back into it this weekend away at Saracens, but they know that it's in their hands. They've got 2 games to play. Saints have got 1 game to play. That race is brilliant. And even inside the playoffs, I was at Leicester Tigers, saw them thump Exeter. They could still leapfrog Sale Sharks into second place. No team has ever won the Premiership finishing third. So even if they end up finishing third, they're hitting the end of the season on a real run of momentum. After Borthwick and Kevin Sinfield left to take charge of England, they lost 3 in a row. They've now won 6 on the bounce in the Premiership, and they're looking really like they've got their rhythm back. Their DNA's back. Visa is,
they got their swag back. People.
They have, mate. Visa smashing people. George Martin, who won an India Cup a couple of years ago, massively highly rated, is now fulfilling that potential in the second row when he had been used at 6. So there's some competition within the top 3. Well, certainly between second and third. But I think, like you say, the focal point of the next 2 weekends in the Prem is Saints or London Irish.
Yeah, I think this weekend will be interesting how it goes with Saris. Irish have had a lot of time to prepare. You know, the European break and a bye week. So it feels like they've been sitting on the shelf for a while. So you feel like they'll be best prepared. I'm assuming Saris are going to bring in a stronger team again. But you just never know with what they've already secured, what they have left. And I think that's probably TBD on that one. And then Irish have, the way it stands, Saints have 1 game left, right? So if Irish win 1 of the 2, they should go through.
So Saints have 53, London Irish have 51. Saints are away at Newcastle on Friday night. So you'd assume Saints would win that game. So Irish then do need to win both. But so Saints play first Friday night, set the goal for London Irish, because they then sit back and wait for Irish to play on Sunday and then Irish to play on the final weekend. So Irish will know what they have to achieve in order to get there. And I think, although you'd want the points in the bag, and if you were Northampton, if you can wake up on Saturday morning having beaten Newcastle away and set the target, you'd be comfortable if you come away with a five-pointer. It's not quite as cut and dried for me as it might be in any other season when a team like Irish would have to go and play Saracens at Exeter, because Saracens have been resting the frontline players. They've got to look after their back row, because their first-choice back row, other than Ben Earl, certainly two of the three are out injured, whether you're talking McFarland or Billy Vunipola, or Christie, Andy Christie, who's been brilliant. He's out injured as well. So they're looking after their resources in this run-in, but they're not going to be at full strength, and they certainly have to look after that back row for the playoffs. So there's an opportunity there for London Irish. And then they play Exeter Chiefs, who are out of the equation in the league, who only have a European semi-final to focus on, and they're already starting to rotate and bring in some new blood in that game against Leicester. So in any other year, you'd say you've got to get two wins out of Saracens and Exeter would be a massive challenge for London Irish. But the way that it's falling for them, there's an opportunity there.
Oh, what it would mean for that club to get into the playoffs, especially with all the issues that, you know, have been going around with the club, potentially off the field, financial long-term solutions being sought to, you know, put yourself in the playoffs is the best way to make yourself attractable for investment and, you know, for long-term funding to be secured. So I think it's a win-win for them if they can pull that off, even if I still think they could be giant killers in the playoffs. Same as Saints. I think whoever slots in that fourth spot, you're not like, oh, sweet. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you know what I mean? If you're first thinking, oh, it's an easy game. Irish are kind of giant killers, and Saints have that ability just to score a hell of a lot of points when they're on the money as well, which make them a tough out. And when they get all their pieces, they're actually very physical in that pack. Like when everyone's fit, like I sometimes underestimate how many carriers they have in that team at the moment, which then, and then their back line using pace and the speed and the width. I think it's a fantastic combination. But I think that's sort of the league, what's going on. There's been a little bit of off-field stuff going on as well. Obviously, there was that Ollie Woodburn second yellow card from Carl Dixon in their game against Leicester, which resulted in a red card, which to some people seems like head-scratching and mind-boggling, the decision. And I think for me, it's when and where these decisions are enforced, because I do think Carl probably has letter of the law and a bit of precedent on his side that there has been this situation before. But it's just the fact that this situation seems to be ignored so many times. Like, how many times do you see guys diving as people are sliding over the line to try and stop them scoring? And so it's, and there's no head contact, no high. So I kind of get the frustrations around the red. And then we've got more the off-field story of people like Jack Knoll, who now are being charged by the RFU for a comment on Twitter with, when this guy's about to potentially, you know, play his last game at Sandy Park, a European final, a semi-final to see out his time at Chiefs, and that's up in the air. It's kind of all turned into a little bit of a tailspin in a matter of days.
You've summed it up perfectly. It's the most rugby union thing that could happen, which, you know, let's start with the fact that the referee in rugby union has a law book that's like that thick that he has to memorise. But his job isn't to enforce every law in that law book, because there would be no game. It's about interpreting the situations at the time and applying them accordingly to help the game flow. And my thing about what happened to Ollie Woodburn is exactly what you say. It's about empathy with the players and applying it at the right moment. Was the law written for that situation? I don't believe it was. Let's just recap for anyone who hasn't seen it. Chris Ashton is heading for the corner. He's tackled by Stuart Hogg. Now, if you go through it frame by frame, Ollie Woodburn starts to slide in as Ashton is coming to the ground, and his intention is to get his arm underneath the ball to prevent the try. And And at the same time, he sort of extends his legs and helps shove Ashton into touch. He's yellow carded for falling on top of a grounded opponent and denying a try scoring opportunity. So penalty try. It was his second yellow card, which is, equates to a red card, which on a tangent, that's just rugby following soccer in their application of two yellows equals a red. And it's never really occurred to me before now, but that's nonsense, because in soccer, if you get a yellow card, it's a warning, you get two, you're sent off. In rugby, you get a yellow card, you're already off for 10 minutes, and it's for a totally separate offence that can be, one can be foul play, one can be technical. You then get a red card. Why could that not just be a second yellow? Could be just another 10 minutes for another offence. If it's the same thing, maybe different. Anyway, that's a tangent. So that's the situation that happened. And he was shown a second yellow card for falling on an opponent, which, by the letter of the law, is a penalty offence. And in fact, a penalty had been awarded for something similar earlier in the game, but in field, when it was a much more of a cynical act to stop a player getting back to their feet. This wasn't a cynical act. This was a rugby act, which an instinctive rugby act to try and be the second man in a tackle and prevent a try. What Carl Dixon said when asked, well, what's the player supposed to do? The answer was, well, he's just supposed to leave the situation and just allow it to unfold. Well, that goes against every instinct of a sportsman, of a rugby player, to just stand there and watch a try being scored. You can't have a game where that's the situation. And then, as Nigel Owens, the former referee, said on Twitter as he reacted to it, all you're doing is encouraging players on a wet day to slide in from 5 meters out, knowing that no one can touch them.
That's what I was going to say. It's wet day, surely that's the move. Yeah. Five, if not more, get top speed and just go.
This
full, like, luge across the ground and no one can touch you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so we're getting into, like, ludicrous situations. And so Carl Dixon, by the letter of the law, he was right. But rugby's about more, or it should be about more than the letter of the law. It's also about spirit, about interpretation, about empathy with the players. And no player understood why that decision was made. And even on the field, Chris Ashton, who'd just been denied his 100th Premiership try, he would later get it, kind of ran back and shook Ronnie Woodburn by the hand with a slightly bemused look on his face. And then back home, the rested Exeter players all took to social media and one way or another expressed their surprise, criticism of the decision. Jack Knowles was charged because his message referred to the decision. I forget the exact wording, but basically I'm shocked by that's the worst decision I've ever seen. Disciplinary hearings is coming up on Thursday. So we'll get the judgment on that. But really, so Exeter today have said what he really meant was he was expressing frustration at the laws of the game. And interestingly, in the last week or so, Rob Baxter, the director of rugby at Exeter, has been speaking a few times about his frustration at rugby's determination that every law change or every piece of discipline that comes in is designed to remove players from the field. And the only sports that do that are soccer and rugby union. And rugby union now do it like to almost on a game-by-game basis, there are players being removed from the field. NFL doesn't do it, NBA doesn't do it. I was watching some of the highlights from the NBA playoffs. Your player gets ejected, but the team don't go down a man permanently. Ice hockey do it, don't they? They've got a sin bin. But, you know, I don't think the team gets shorthanded for the rest of the game. Yeah, so we've got this situation in rugby union where it started with trying to use sanctions to force players to change the way they behave, i.e. lower the height of the tackle. And it's debatable, arguable, whether that's actually working. I think players have just got to a position now where they accept that there has to be a level of risk about what they do, and now and again they're going to get a yellow card for it. Rugby's got itself into this tangle about trying to enforce all the laws to the letter under the scope of the TMO and the focus of the cameras.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic, because we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And those who are running the game are not listening to what the players are saying. That's what gets me about this.
Yeah. And the thing I always find difficult is like the line of what you're allowed to say and not with these decisions. Like, you know, like he's not directly criticized or slagged off the ref or tried to call him, you know, like he was biased or, you know, like, do you know what I mean? There was some motivation behind it. Like in rugby, you get judged by split second incidents, like on the outcome and like not the intent or whatever behind it. And then, if you're a referee, you've got these splits that you've got to make these tough decisions. You're like, as a, like the average fan can say whatever they want on Twitter. And because you're a player, you can't even say whether you think you agree with it or not. Saying it's the worst decision that you've ever seen. It's a bit extreme and dramatic. And that's probably the bit that got him in trouble more than the beginning bit of I'm shocked, what is going on or whatever. But to me, it's still like very, like, if anything, I would like to see things like this. If there's an issue, potentially you get, you know, a rugby community service issue. You maybe pay a fine. Do you know what I mean? Maybe you go to, you do retraining. But to actually miss games and stuff for that, I think is like, I almost think it's almost too much power. Like, I understand there's a code of ethics and you're bound by it and you sign up to the RFU disciplinary procedures. I just think, like, what do you think the outcome is going to be? Because we're recording this on the day of Jack Knoll's hearings. By the time it comes out, his hearing's going to come out. But you're sitting here now. What do you think the RFU do?
I think they should do exactly what you say. So there's a precedent of sorts with Tom Youngs, who was effectively sent on a referee's course. Now, I do think that it's important. You know, rugby prides itself, and sometimes it's a little, it kind of sticks in the throat a bit, but it prides itself on its levels of respect. As a sport, you know, it sells itself on being a respectful sport, a disciplined sport. And you want to encourage referees to come in. We're not in a position where grassroots soccer is, certainly in this country, where, you know, referees are the talk of them wearing like GoPro cameras because they're under physical threat. We're nowhere near that. But we don't really even get close to that. So I understand the importance of respecting the officials, but I also understand emotion. Sport is emotion, and it was a little outburst. And if he just like went and recorded a little chat with Carl Dixon, and Carl Dixon explaining what he did, and Jack Knoll was made to sort of apologise or just said, right, listen, it was a heat in the moment. For me, something that would demonstrate a level of respect towards the officials for me would be enough. And I think if he was to be banned, it would be way over the top from the RFU. And I think actually, you know, if you went and did a level one refereeing course or it went and engaged and refereed some school matches or something, just did a bit of something that helps him understand. For me, that's as far as it needs to go. That you don't need any suspensions for this. It was an emotional reaction. It was critical of the decision. But I don't think it was undermining the referee. But there are ways of handling it that don't require a suspension. But, you know, his situation at Exeter should be irrelevant to the decision. It would be a shame if he got any bans that prevented him from seeing out the season with Exeter. I'd be surprised if
it would be a travesty, mate. Obviously, he made a mistake, but it would be a travesty if it went that far for me. And so, fingers crossed, And I guess people will know the outcome probably as they're listening to this. So, you know, we could be bang on or we could be so far off on the RFU throw the book at him. And that's what the rest of the Newsweek stories will be like. But we'll park Woodburn now. One thing I wanted to get your thoughts on or touch on quickly is just what's going on with Worcester Warriors at the moment, maybe WAS as well, and just a little bit of update. I'm seeing rumblings on Twitter. I saw Andy Goode calling out Jim O'Toole and James Sanford. And basically, you know, saying that they're trying to basically do a land grab and ruining the club and they should step aside and let someone else, you know, rescue the club who wants to preserve Cecil Duckworth's legacy or something like that. What is going on there and what's the latest of where we sit right now?
Well, the two situations are different. So I'll start with Worcester. They will not return to the Championship next season. So when they were forcibly relegated and suspended because they'd gone into administration, the RFU held a registration for Worcester Warriors in the Championship, the second tier. The new owners have declined to take up that license in the second tier. And the reason is that if Worcester returned in the Championship, those owners, as Worcester Warriors, those owners would be bound to pay all the creditors of the club, which is a bill of up to something like £8 million. So all the players who didn't get paid, all the staff and the coaches and the backroom employees who didn't get paid, they would all have to be paid up. Any rugby creditor would have to be paid. So what the owners have tried to do, have talked about doing, is dropping down a few levels further. There's a local club called Stourbridge, and they're looking to effectively buy that club's first 15 license and rename them. The original proposal was to rename them Six Ways after the stadium and slot back in a few levels further down and then rebuild back up to the Championship and the Prem. The RFU have made it very clear that they will not permit anyone to just buy their way into the league. So as we sit here now, there is no Worcester Warriors. There's nobody holds that license. So if Worcester Warriors were to return, they'd have to do it right at the very bottom of the pyramid and work their way back up. But the owners have said that they're not
interested. Richmond or somewhere.
Hello Richmond. But these owners have said they're not interested in doing that. And so what they have is a rugby as a site with a stadium and no rugby team playing there. The women's team currently play there. And I think Worcester Football Club's soccer club have played there, but only on a rental basis. So that's what Andy Goode is referring to. There's the site of Worcester Warriors exists, but the club itself does not. And so a city the size of Worcester with its rugby heritage going back to the 1800s won't have a pro team. There is an amateur team there called Worcester RFC who play just next door to Six Ways, but no pro team will be in place in that city.
And the question for me is, you know, were the RFU aware of these intentions when they actually approved them as the buyers? And were they already aware that they were going to try and circumvent paying the rugby creditors, which to me is wild? And then was Steve Diamond and other bids, were they willing to pay the creditors? And was there an option where the rugby creditors could have been paid?
Yes, there was. And Steve Diamond was involved in one of the consortiums who was committed to doing that and to returning Worcester Warriors into the Championship. The RFU have actually written just in the last week to all those credited ex-players and employees to outline that they were not involved in choosing who the club was sold to. That was done purely through the administrators. And so the RFU are saying that the fact that it's ended up with owners who aren't interested in returning to the Championship is not the fault of the RFU. It's the system, the way that the administrators chose that bid over any other bid.
Well, that's Worcester and where they sit right now. So I guess TBD on how this one unfolds. I believe they have 90 days to close or whatever this deal. And if not, then there's potential of other bids coming back into the fray. I saw Steve Diamond saying they need a month or so to get back up and running with whatever bid or consortium he was behind. But that's Worcester. What's going on at WAS right now?
So WAS is a different situation. They have they will be returning into the Championship next season under new ownership that was sort of led by a group of former players, former Wasps players, the Wasps Legends Club. But they have other issues. They have some funding issues, from what I understand. There are some ambitious plans to build a stadium near the current training ground, call it the Wasps Nest Stadium. As it stands, they think they can play some of their championship games at their training ground, which is only a couple of years old. It's a really special facility, but actually, and it ties them to the Midlands. But as it stands, they have no players. We're not aware of any coaching staff being employed, so they've got some catching up to do. They haven't met all the criteria that the RFU laid down, which included sort of funding and finances and such like to get them to this point. Quite how they then rebuild the club is a whole other question, but they are due to return in the championship. And the sport needs a brand like Wasps. I say brand because they've always been a nomadic club. And I think if you were to be honest and to start again with the brand of Wasps, you wouldn't leave it in the Midlands because there are already a lot of clubs in the Midlands. You'd move it to the southeast in Kent, perhaps, because there's a big rugby community there that would really engage with a club like Wasps. But that's not going to happen. They are going to return. They're likely to stay in the Midlands, and the sport needs Wasps because of their history. You know, they're champions of England, champions of Europe. As you know, that history is valuable.
Yeah. Fascinating how they'll get up to speed. They're going to have to do some regressive recruitment because the Champs no easy league to stay up in as well. And they have relegation as well. And you've got teams that are obviously, have a lot of continuity and already have squads, infrastructure, all this stuff. So it's kind of, and you don't even know the coaches or what way they're going. It's a big, huge TBD. And I think that transitioned us to probably the end topic of this pod that I wanted to talk about is Premiership Rugby. Big picture, you know, we've talked about the on-field product is at an all-time high. I think the rugby's going the best it is, the competitiveness of the league, that is not an issue. The issues are the finances of the league and the long-term sustainability and where the potential is to turn this into a better financial model where the clubs are in a sustainable position to continue and be competitive in Europe and be able to actually spend enough on their playing squad that they're able to put on a product that's competitive like that. But then also the other issue that's glaring to me is you've got the Premiership at its all-time best on-field product, and you've probably got the England team at one of their worst moments on-field for a long time. And the two don't seem to synergize together, which for me is part of the big issue of this Premiership RFU conundrum, that it's here and here. Instead of aligning the houses and looking at some of the other teams that seem to be very successful, that, you know, have one or two teams where the majority of their players are playing at and they have resources, and then they transition to the national team. And so that's kind of my opening statement or monologue to this, but what's your take?
Wow, there is so much that they're trying to correct. The executives at Premiership Rugby, the RFU, and the Rugby Players Association are in talks about a whole new framework that would cover the professional game in England. The current agreement expires next year, and they need a whole new approach to the elite game. What they need, and what I think they're working towards, is almost a joint venture, so that you don't have the clubs here in England here. You have a body. At the moment, they're sort of bridged by a body called the Professional Game Board, which is a toothless talking shop that doesn't have any authority, really, to make... That needs to become, that needs to go to the top. So you have a body at the top that makes decisions that cover all professional rugby in England. That includes the England team. That's what they're aiming towards. But there are so many strands to what you're talking about there. One is, it's, you know, the players. So at the moment, English players are being attracted to move to France. England players are being attracted to move to France. Because we've got a situation where the salary cap is still depressed at 5 million, although the clubs spend more than that because of allowances and such like, but it's at a depressed level, and a whole load of contracts are coming up all at once, a year out before the salary cap goes back up. So the clubs can't afford to keep them, so that's why you're seeing a Luke Cowan-Dickie and a Joe Marchant, sort of 5, 6, 7 England players moving to France. the Premiership are confident that once the cap goes back up in a year or two's time, the Premiership will be a more financially attractive league for players. The issue, though, is that the club still can't afford those players because they're all making a loss. And you talked about London Irish earlier. Their owner, Mick Clawson, said about a year ago he would give the club away for a pound because they're carrying £30 million worth of debt. They're in talks at the moment about a takeover with US investors interested, but they haven't got it over the line yet. And it's really hard to persuade investors to invest in this league at the moment when the structure of the competition is also confusing. And there's been a lot of research done. You know, they have 11 teams at the moment, which is effectively a 12-team league because it includes a bye. They're going to move it down to 10. It's going to drop to 10. And one of the reasons why that is to keep the Premiership outside of Six Nations and also international windows. So you don't have this overlap. You don't have Saracens playing Northampton, one of the great traditional rivalries of the last 10, 15 years, with none of their England players there. What's the point? What's attractive about that? What does it do to the narrative of the season when you've got these big games that should be, you know, these are live TV games. They should be the sellout matches, but they're being lost because the focus is somewhere else. So they want a less is more approach to matches, to create a season that works better, that people can understand more. The players are therefore available more often because they're not away with England at the same time as their club are playing. So all of these things are interlinked. I think at the heart of it is this deal that the clubs are trying to negotiate with the RFU, which will include player management, will include funding, will include the structure of the Premiership. And I'm telling you, it hasn't been announced. They can't confirm it yet, but they will drop it to 10 teams. How they do it is another question, whether it's just a relegation season and whoever finishes bottom gets lost. Be pretty brutal, but they believe they need to be at 10 teams because it allows them to solve, or at least attempt to solve, so many of the other issues around the commerciality of the sport, around, you know, playing the big games with all the star players there. It's too confused at the moment. You know, as we said earlier, London Irish haven't played for a month. Part of it's because there was a bye week. Like, it needs to be. There's a whole lot of things that are all interconnected that need to be solved. And that's the work that's ongoing at the moment. And there's no quick fix to this because the league will continue losing money for a long time. But they're going to make some fairly drastic moves to improve the structure of the season, make it a better fan experience in the stadiums. Yeah, they've looked at the NFL and how, was it 10, 15 years ago now? I remember reading a piece where the NFL had come to realise that the TV product was so good and the tickets were so expensive that people were not going to the games. So that's why we now have these, you know, mega screens, all the info. If you go to an NFL game, you are as clued up about what's happening as the person watching at home. And in Premiership Rugby at the moment, you're not. Let's go back to Ollie Woodburn. Nobody at Welford Road, 25,000 people, would have had any idea why he'd been sent off. And that just doesn't encourage people to attend. So a load of things I've just fired at you there. Yeah. They're all interconnected, actually. Yeah. But it all comes down to how can they improve the engagement of the league? How can they make it an appointment to view every weekend? And at the moment, it's not, because they will hold matches when England are playing. And by definition means it can't be appointment to view.
That's all positive that those two are at least speaking and trying to draw up an agreement, like, because obviously they have an agreement. But that's where I've always thought the issues are with the English system, and it's part of the reason why revenues are so hard to generate in the Prem, and it's also part of the reason why the England team's hard to get it really successful, is because of this club country divide. And like, for me, looking from the outside, I see the RFU, who are the richest union in the world. They have genuine assets they could leverage for cash. They generate a lot of revenue with Twickenham and that. Then you've got their team, which, you know, if that team is successful, the revenue and the cash and everything, the pie keeps growing. And then you've got Premiership Rugby, who are the feeder to that national team, who really are the core driver of the academy system, the development, everything going on. Hemorrhaging cash, unable to find a revenue situation, multiple teams that run at a loss, which could, you know, on a dime, evaporate like we've seen two this season. What if the RFU actually bought in to all the clubs? Like, say the two or three that are struggling, that can't, that's how you get rid of them. They get a buyout from that RFU cash and they get the money, cuts off the debts, pays off the creditors. They're out with their cash. Now we've got 10 or 9 teams or 8 teams. And maybe the teams that RFU buy or buy out, they become championship teams in the long term. And you put a small... I still think 10 teams is too much from thinking about it. Like, I've been thinking about it. If you wanted the England team to be really successful, look at Ireland. How many... They got, what, 3 provinces? 4 provinces?
Four, yeah.
Ireland have 4 provinces. What if we had 6, 8? Or even if we had 4? Imagine if you had a North... a Midlands, a Southeast, and a Southwest, and that was your fan base. And they only played when the national team weren't playing. Like, all of a sudden now you're generating a lot more revenue. They obviously couldn't just play a league in themselves and have to draw a whole new model. But just the fact, when I look from the outside in, it's like, if you're the RFU, you've got to be coming in with your cash, trying to, you see a wounded animal here that needs help, that it actually feeds into your system and your machine, that there's got to be a deal that makes sense for the restructure. Because to me, like, I'm a big believer the club season's way too long. I almost think personally, looking at it, that almost every union should be co-buying into their league to restructure the season through World Rugby, through Grant, whichever way you've got to get it done. That if you're able to redraw the season of when the club and country windows are, you could put together the best European window of club rugby. You could have the league. You could have the European champions play the super champions. That ends. And then you'd have 5-6 months of international rugby or whatever. And then you'd run your champ or as an ITM, as a shoot shield, or as a lower comp that goes on during those windows. It keeps your player pool big. And then those guys have 6 months of a champ wage. And the better ones have another 4 months of club wage. And the top internationals have their club wage and their international wage. And it, like... then you've also redrawn the lines that club and country can be very profitable together. Obviously, I'm an outlier in my thinking.
If you're building English professional club rugby from scratch, that is what you do, but you're not. And so you're, and you're, you know, if you only have to look in Wales, where they've tried to manufacture regional teams, and they just, you talk about the assumption there that if you had a North, South, East and West, you know, regional teams in England, it would improve revenue. You've got such historic clubs that are rooted in their community that you're asking Leicester and Northampton fans to go and support the same team.
Yeah, but let me just equate that. So you'd ask them, so for 6 months, they'd probably have their club team still, or 4 months or 5 months. And then you're asking them potentially in a European comp or something, where now you've got, I would say, very similar to the Lions. Like, Scots, Welsh, English fans hate each other, but they come together for the Lions when their players come together. Now you've got your regional heartland. And the reason why I think the regions work is because there is a bit of regional pride in England already. The Northerners, they're their own little group. Midlands have that pride. That southwest of rugby from, you know, Cornwall to Devon, like, that area is massive rugby heartland that has an identity. And then London, obviously, with the southeast, that would probably have to be grouped in with it, also has an identity. And I don't know, like, I know it's a pipe dream and it's like an outlier thought, and your explanation of that the system's too far gone to redraw, it just, from a utopian view, it makes so much sense.
Yeah, it does. You also have to redraw the whole European competition, which you won't get the French to agree with. That's the other issue, that to do it your way, you'd play,
yeah, that's the issue season. Is the French clubs, I was thinking, have too much,
yeah,
you money.
Have a domestic season flowing into a European season, which would feature the English regions. Again, if you're starting from scratch, you might have a chance, but you'd have to, you're trying to persuade the French to change their model, and they will not do so. So,
because they actually generate revenue.
Just going back to what you said about, you know, the kind of confliction between club and country, like, Eddie Jones did not do anything to help relations between the clubs and England. Like, he was quite dismissive of the Premiership, and the way that he dealt with players and clubs meant that Steve Borthwick is sort of starting from scratch, trying to rebuild relationships. If you can build proactive relationships and trust, then you can get the two, like, structures pulling in the same direction. And it's small things like the GPS units that the players wear for England. used to be different and the data managed differently to the units that they were with their clubs, so that you could, there was never any facility to join the information together and for one to access the other. Now they're all using the same, so that the England medics and physios and coaches have all exactly the same information that the clubs have. So stuff like that is changing slowly and bringing them more aligned. And one of the jobs that Borthwick has is to try and create that relationship, which basically was just disintegrated, certainly in the last few years under Eddie Jones.
All fair points, mate. You know, mine's a pipe dream, but I just like getting out on the record, especially as I got my own pod. But I think that's a good place to wrap it up, mate. Thank you for playing Devil's Advocate, and thanks for all your insight and info, and just always constantly being a friend of the pod. We really appreciate it, mate, and look forward to catching up with you soon.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a big end to the season coming up now in the Prem and Europe, so I'll see you back on here shortly.
And that is a wrap on this week's show. Thank you so much to Alex. So much good insight there. Obviously, as well, he doesn't call me crazy for some of my ideas, which I appreciate as well. I am obviously very aware I'm a bit of an outlier, an outside-the-box thinker to at least those that seem to run the game. But anyway, thanks so much for the support. A big shout-out as well last week for the Christy Kershey episode. I thought she was a great interview, great to come on, and we got a lot of good feedback and good traction from it. And so we'll keep trying to have as many guests from the women's game as well. Premiership Rugby this weekend is live and on demand across Peacock TV in the United States. It is down to the wire. So much to go into these last couple of weeks to find out who those final playoff spots will be and where they'll finish up. So do not miss that. But from all of us here at NBC Sports and myself, Alex Corbacero, thank you so much for listening, for watching. We'll see you again next week.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.